Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Stunning developments in South Korea overnight, a declaration of martial law, which the parliament quickly moves to reverse. Scaling up with native seeds, we take a closer look at the beginnings of a garden of sorts on the Pineapple Island. And NPR just released the 2024 Books We Love list. There are a couple on there with island ties, including one about a British explorer celebrated in other parts of the world, but doesn't have quite the shiny reputation here. And do we have a baseball story for you today? We explore a vintage league starting up here on Oahu. We're talking wool uniforms, heavy bats, and those classic tiny mitts. Tune the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Dramatic developments overnight in South Korea, an emergency declaration of martial law, the first time in almost 50 years, and then a reversal. HPR's news director Bill Dorman joins us here with the latest. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Catherine. As you say, dramatic, totally unexpected, and now on its way to being reversed. It's just after 6 a.m. Wednesday morning now in Seoul. President Yoon Suk-yeol has said that he's going to lift his martial law order after he meets with his cabinet this morning. He went on national television last night around 10:30. Again, totally unexpected, declared that martial law would be in effect as of 11 p.m. He said in part in his statement, "I declare martial law to protect the Republic of Korea from the threats of North Korean communist forces, to immediately eradicate the unscrupulous Pyongyang anti-state forces that pillage the freedom and happiness of our people," went on. Although he invoked North Korea, it appears to be very much about domestic politics. That was hinted at by an early U.S. reaction. Deputy Secretary of State Kirk Campbell, he was the top U.S. official to comment on that. He is really a key point person for the administration on Asia. He's been around the block, certainly policy-wise. He's previously coordinator for Indo-Pacific Affairs, the National Security Council. Back in the Obama administration, he was Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. He actually was the guy who coined the phrase the pivot to Asia, if you recall that. You can hear the caution in his voice when he gave an early reaction to what was still a developing story.
So we are watching the recent developments in the ROK with grave concern. We're seeking to engage our ROK counterparts at every level, both here and in Seoul. The President, the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State have all been briefed on developments and are being kept appraised of the situation as it unfolds. I do want to underscore that our alliance with the ROK is ironclad, and we stand by Korea in their time of uncertainty. I also want to just underscore that we have every hope and expectation that any political disputes will be resolved peacefully and in accordance with the rule of law. We'll have more to say as the situation develops.
And apart from the alerts, you might imagine no substantive impact on U.S. forces stationed in South Korea. Pentagon officials also had little to say when reporters asked them about details. This is Air Force Major General Pat Ryder.
First, Secretary Austin and the Department of Defense continue to monitor the developing situation in the Republic of South Korea. The United States is in close contact with the ROK government to learn more and is closely monitoring developments. As we have any updates to provide, we'll be sure to pass them along as appropriate.
Yeah, they sure were cagey. Not releasing much information at all.
And that's, fair enough. They don't know very much. I think everyone in the D.C. policy establishment had that same reaction.
What?
Wait, what?
Yeah.
South Korea did what? And again, this idea that this political dispute has been simmering for some time in South Korea. President Yoon Suk-yeol, his party is conservative, the PPP, the People Power Party. But the parliament is controlled by the opposition, the Democratic Party, which is more liberal. have been a series of policy clashes. The budget has really been a focus because the Democratic Party has shrunk basically the administration request, and the president has become visibly angry about this. But again, this was unexpected in terms of this set of developments.
And, you know, it's just amazing, you know, because of the ties that we have with Korea, and you know, many of us have family over there and a little worried about the tensions.
Well, it's, again, I think the domestic politics of South Korea is something you got to step back and take a look at. It's been since 1980 that martial law was imposed, but recall that there's been this carousel of South Korean leaders coming out of office and going into prison. One of the ironies of all of this is President Yoon Suk-yeol rose to political prominence as part of the prosecution team of former President Park Geun-hye, who now is in prison. And again, that the internal politics of Korea, and what you heard from U.S. officials, is this very cautious separation between national security, security aspects of this, and the domestic political situation in South Korea. We're going to see more. There's so much context that still needs to come from South Korea. We'll have better ideas the day goes on. And we'll see what happens next for Yoon himself. Early chaotic hours after declaration of martial law, some 190 members of the 300 National Assembly gathered, voted unanimously against the move, including 18 members of Yoon's party. Don't know the dynamics of that meeting, but I've been in that National Assembly building in Seoul, and security can be sealed off and tightly controlled.
Yeah, lots of eyes on this situation for sure.
Yeah.
A little fracturing in our region, in the Pacific. But thank you so much, Bill.
You bet.
We've been talking with HPR's Bill Dorman. There are said to be some 28,000 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. And again, the Pentagon says they have not been impacted. This week, a plan to begin building a seed bank on Lanai will start to take shape. A shipping container that will serve as a storage facility has just arrived on the Pineapple Isle. A $200,000 grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, awarded to Terraformation for the year-long project, will go to jumpstart the native Hawaiian seed collection. We talked to Johannes Seidel, director of the Hawaii Forestry Operations recently, about his team will be moving into high gear this month in an area east of Lanai City.
This grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation enables us to set up a seed banking and seed collection program for what is called the Kuahiwi Akai Watershed Restoration Program on the island of Lanai. That's a 20,000-acre project area for which we'll be starting to collect seeds. Setting something like this up, I'd say we'll approach this from two angles. One is kind of the living environment, and then the other one is the built part of it. That's the seed bank. And the living environment, that's the community on Lanai and our partner, Pulama Lanai, and that has been what we've been focused on over the past several months. So establishing relationships, building trust with our partner. And now we're moving into the second phase of that first part, which will be going on island, understanding the landscape, the ecosystem, so which plants, which species can be found where, when are they flowering, when are they producing seeds, so we can go out and do efficient seed collecting. We'll be going into the right spots at the right time so we can collect as many seeds as possible. And the build part of it, that's the seed bank itself that already arrived on Lanai, is a shipping container that is a built-out container that has everything you need to clean and process and store seeds inside. So it's fully off-grid solar battery powered, and inside it has things like refrigeration, freezers, dehumidification, air conditioning, countertops, for workspace. It has a sink and all kind of other tools and equipment that's needed to process and store seeds properly. The shipping container is really sturdy. Usually those are on like a small concrete foundation, so they're locked in place. But at the same time, it can be picked up and moved to a different location. Right? For example, if it's specific for a project is completed, we'll take the solar panels and the racks back down, put everything back, secure it, and we could ship it into a different location.
When you step up a project like this, how much time do you have to have out in the field, you know, or have you pretty much, you know, set up a grid and figured out a plan, a blueprint for how you do this methodically?
That's a very difficult question. I guess you can really never have enough time to collect seeds. It can be a very labor-intensive process, right? We're going into the wild. It has a lot to do, of course, with accessibility, how much or how many roads are there that we can rely on? How much do we have to walk to access species that we want for propagation and then outplanting in the restoration project? And key is also to understand the cycle of the plants. When are there seeds? When can we go and collect which kind of species that we want? So ideally, you have at least a 1 year window to do this kind of work, because different species flower and seed at different times. And when you cover a year, there's a good chance that you at least can collect one time from each of the different species. And so the grant is for a year, so it should give us a good opportunity to collect and start a decent repository for this project.
Well, you know, we all saw with what happened with Lahaina, you know, those wildfires swept in. And when we were trying to figure out how do you prevent, you know, the runoff and then how do you reseed the area, we just didn't have enough native seeds banked. So I guess this is really preventive. We see where there are gaps in our supply.
Yeah, that's very true, Catherine. That's actually one of the main reasons why we had put thought into developing the seed bank, because we really saw that the seed supply from native plants to do restoration is a huge bottleneck to forest restoration worldwide, actually. And it's not only here in Hawaii. And these seed bank units were developed with that in mind. So we make something that is somewhat affordable, easy to build, but at the same time allows an organization to properly process and store seeds. So this is a working seed bank. So the thought behind it is that seeds go in and get out and are not stored for many, many decades. It's not something like the Svalbard seed vault, for example, that's in the permafrost where we store seeds for millennia or something like this. It's a working seed bank, so seeds get in and get out into the restoration, but at the same time, it has everything you need to create a seed stock over several years, and the seeds stay viable because they're processed and stored properly. And so when the restoration site is ready for the planting, for example, when you know, the last foot of the fence is completed, then the team can go into the seed bank, simply pull the seeds out and start the propagation process. And we don't lose time by starting with collecting seeds first, because it can be a long process and a year might go by until you get the right seeds. And by then, invasive species might have moved in already.
In this landscape that you're going to be focusing on, is there a zone, a particular zone that you're going to start in?
Yeah, so our partner, Pulama Lanai, who really have been fantastic over the past months in sharing their local expertise and knowledge and also data that they have been putting together with other organizations over the past years to really understand their landscape. They've shared data with us that allows us to already plan ahead before we set our first foot on the ground for the seed collecting, which will be later this year, before the holiday break. We're going to have a week-long trip on island and collect and bank our first seeds. And this data that they shared shows things like certain species that are important for this restoration site. Where can they be found? So we can already plan on here are certain areas where we should start the seed collecting process, see if the plants are seeding right now, and don't just wander around, because it's a large project area. and time is of essence. We want to make sure we can collect as many seed or Lanai as possible through the duration of this grant. And so their help has been tremendously helpful already. We have to be very strategic. You know, resources are always limited, especially for the natural resources, I feel like. So we want to be as effective as we can so we can get as much done as possible. The project area has invasive species on there. It has highly erodible areas, and so we want to collect seeds so we can prevent more erosion in the future. It's about resilience, because creating that seed stock, in this example, it will be for Lanai and for the Kuahiwiakai watershed program area. But by having that, if there is a natural disaster or something like this, you'll be able to go into the seed bank and pull out seeds and start propagation right away, so you can get these plants into the landscape as quickly as possible.
And this watershed area, is it already protected by fencing, or will you folks have to do some of that basic work?
Fencing is underway. We are not involved in this. There are other organizations that work on that, and the whole project is gearing up towards that active restoration part of it. So it's preparing the data analysis, they worked on understanding the landscape, and the fencing is underway. And so this is the next step to create that seed stock to then start the active restoration project.
I ask about that, about the fencing, just because of things like pigs or deer. You don't want them to come into the areas that you have planted seed or are trying to harvest seed and have them, you know, disrupt the area.
Yes, it's so true. Most of our staff here is on Hawaii Island. We can see the goats and the sheep every time I drive from the Kona side to the Hilo side, right along the highway. The fence is always the first step of more or less any work we do in restoration, because we want to make sure that the plants we put out in the field have the highest chance of survival. There's so much love and effort and work going into getting these saplings healthy in the nursery. So we can't afford to put them in places where they then just get eaten up by these ungulates, and we just have to start all over. Unfortunately, we have to deal with these fences here, but over there, it's on the way. That's a critical first step. But other things can happen at the same time, right, to start to get ready for the active restoration part. I forgot to mention that might be useful and helpful is that, you know, the seed bank is accompanied by a software product. It's called TerraWare that we've been working on, and that allows us to track everything. So that's the tech angle of it. We go into the field and we take GPS points from where we collect the seeds, and then they go into the TerraWare system. And then eventually these seeds will be tracked through the nursery and into the outplanting site. Because doing this restoration with a multitude of species is very complicated.
We've been hearing from Johannes Seidel, Director of Hawaii Forestry Operations for Terraformation. That organization currently operates two nurseries, three restoration sites, and a seed bank on the island of Hawaii. Its current project is a joint effort with Palama Lanai to help with the conservation and restoration efforts of some 20,000 acres on the island.
The sight of the Russian flag stirs up mixed emotions for a lot of people in Russia, depending on whether they see it as a symbol of their rich culture and history or just war.
It's an open question if this flag represents us or it doesn't anymore. Just nobody knows.
That debate next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umaui, ukahoolabe, uhawaii.
Today we're jumping into sports history to spotlight baseball history, trailblazer Wally Yonamine. Born in 1925 during Hawaii's territorial days, he actually played a season of professional football before his baseball career took off. In one season for the San Francisco 49ers, he had 19 carries and 3 passes for about 100 yards total and was the first Japanese-American to play pro football. In 1951, Yonamine joined the Yomiuri Kyojin, or Giants as they're known outside of Japan. He played there for 9 seasons before joining the Chunichi Dragons in 1960. He played on the Dragons for another 2 seasons before retiring and eventually became the team's manager in the mid-70s. He was inducted into the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame in 1994 for his achievements and to this day is the only American player admitted to its ranks. Wally Yonamine remains one of Hawaii's most distinguished homegrown athletes. And for today's backyard quiz, we're asking you to name the sparsely populated Hawaii community where this baseball legend was born. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
The transformative power of classical music on HPR2 helps make Hawaii a better place. Listener contributions are vital in keeping classical music accessible to everyone. Classical music inspires and provides moments of calm in a hectic and challenging world. This moment matters. Keep HPR2 strong into the new year and beyond. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Hanahaoli School Professional Development Center, supporting the island's teachers who help to pave the path for a better future for the children of Hawaii. Learn more at hanahaoli.org/PDC.
NPR's annual Books We Love list is out. Several books with Hawaii ties have made that list in the past. They include Aloha Rodeo, which tells the story of Hawaii's Paniolo, and To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara, who attended Punahou School. This year's list features 2 books Hawaii readers may find particularly interesting. One is a biography of Captain James Cook, and the other is a young adult fantasy novel by a writer from Guam. The Conversation's Russell Subiono talked to NPR's Culture Desk correspondent Andrew Limbang.
One of the books on the list that caught my attention was The Wide Sea by Hampton Sides. As you know, it's a biography of James Cook, the British sea captain who explored the Pacific. Captain Cook is an interesting historical figure. He's celebrated in some places. I know there's a statue of him in downtown Anchorage, Alaska, but he's not held in such high regard here in Hawaii. There's a monument to where he was killed in Kealakekua Bay on the Big Island. What more do we learn about Cook in the Wide Sea?
Yeah, so this book was recommended by Steve Inskeep, host of Morning Edition Up First. And in it, I think what he, in his blurb, I think what he stresses upon is like the details, the depth that the Hampton Sides goes into about like the ship and like that sort of, you know, you ever read like a history book and it doesn't feel real, right? It doesn't feel like the texture of the world isn't there. And I think that's something that Hampton Sides does, right? He sort of like brings you to life, brings that world to life. And I think like any good in-depth but like history, and I should say this guy's pretty long. It's on our rather long. It's included in our, we can sort of like categorize them by length, and this one is listed under rather long. with any good biography or history of that death, I think you trying to get like all sides of a story, right? Like pockmarks and all. And I think it's a way to like both introduce people to Cook, but also like give the whole texture of his life.
Yeah, it sounds like it does a good job of telling a larger story. I'm hoping that maybe it touches on why he was held in such high esteem by some people, and maybe also gives an account of his demise here in Hawaii. How much do you know about kind of the high points it touches on?
Not much. I'll be real. I haven't read this book. Like the thing about books we love is that we send out like this email like around September, I think, to all the staff, right? And so for people to like come in and chip in with like some of their favorite reads. And so it's a great time for me to like catch up on any of the books that I haven't like, that have like slipped by my radar. And so this one, you know, Inskeep felt really strongly about it. And so I gotta give a shout out to him and you know, his work in getting the book done.
Yeah, I think here in Hawaii, it'd be a good read for our listeners to kind of get a broader context of who he was, especially leading up to his death here in the islands. Another book that's on the list that caught my eye was Makia Lussier's Dragon Fruit, which is described as a young adult romantic fantasy novel inspired by Pacific Islander mythology. What can you tell us about this book?
Yeah, it is under... our young adult. It's also like a sci-fi fantasy and speculative fiction, which I think like the young adult fantasy space. I don't know if how many books in that world you read. It does get kind of crowded, and I don't think it's bad to say that sometimes things can feel a little, let's say, samey, right? but this book was recommended by Kalyani Saxena, who's a producer over at A Here and Now. And in her blurb, she says that like this is, it's like a unique fantasy world that is both like lush, right, and rich, and it, you know, it is inspired by a Pacific Islander mythology. But I imagine as a fantasy world, it, you know, there's like fantasy stuff in it.
yeah, and
it'll know, take its liberties, but that's great, you know.
Yeah, and I know the YA market is one that is full of different varieties of types of books and is very popular. Dragon Fruit's author Makia Lussier, she grew up on the Pacific island of Guam, which has many ties to Hawaii, and so it kind of makes sense to me that our listeners might find a connection to her novel. I've talked to many local filmmakers about the slow but growing increase in diverse voices in their industry. Do you find that as the years go on, there is a similar parallel in the book industry? What are your thoughts on diversity within NPR's Books We Love guide in recent years?
Yeah, I think in meeting with, especially meeting with like book publicists, right? When they're trying to pitch us, you know, their slate for the upcoming, you know, Q1 releases, Q2 releases, right? And so when you meet with them regularly, there is a hint of people trying to promote more, like, let's call them, for lack of a better term, it's a kind of academic term, but like marginalized voices or whatever, right? And I think they're interested in that. But then I'm also interested in writers of color who are kind of pushing back on that. Like what I mean is, like one of the books I recommended was this book called Victim, and it's by Andrew Borrega, and it's about a Latino writer who kind of fudges his background in order to get ahead in the writing game. And so the main character finds himself in all of these well-meaning, like, white liberal circles, right, who deem him like the voice of a marginalized people, even though he's kind of full of it. And it's a pretty hilarious and like acerbic satire on the literary industrial complex, if you will. And, you know, like any great book about liars, like, it doesn't stand up the whole way through, and once it all comes falling down, it's a really funny and entertaining watch. And so I think what that book is trying to say is that there is a move to promote diverse authors, but let's be real, it's like book selling is a business. Whatever sells is what sells, right?
Yeah, echoes of American fiction in the storyline for that book. Yeah. Are there any books on the list or in Andrew's picks that you'd like to highlight or that you would be excited for Hawaii readers to pick up?
Speaking of, you know, you just mentioned American fiction. That book was based off of a book by Percival Everett, who's got another book out this year called James, which is a retelling of Huck Finn, but through Jim's point of view. And I think anybody interested in the mythology that this country tells itself, right, and the stories that we were once like made to believe is true, would get a lot out of this retelling of, you know, what's heralded as a classic in American literature. But Everett is really good at putting a twist on what American literary history really says.
Oh, that sounds so interesting. Andrew Limbong, thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate talking to you, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Russell.
That was NPR's Andrew Limbong talking to HPR's Russell Subiano about the 2024 Books We Love list. We'll have a link to it on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Brendan Carr wrote Project 2025's chapter on the Federal Communications Commission. His top goal? Reining in big tech. Now, Donald Trump has tapped Carr to be the next FCC chairman.
Step one for me is to make sure I continue to work with President Trump and his team over the coming weeks as the transition is complete. I want to make sure that I understand 100% President Trump's agenda.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Saturday night on The Real Deal. More songs and recordings from 1924. Music of 100 years ago. And a lot of the songs are still in circulation today. I'm Seth Marco. Join me on HPR 1 from 8 to 10 for The Real Deal.
What do you get when you cross historical reenactment with America's favorite pastime? Well, vintage baseball, which a local artist hopes will take off in Hawaii. Matias Solario is a visual artist who lives in Waikiki. He's been working with the old Queen Street Stadium, a sports museum and clothing store, to bring back old school baseball. Think top hats and tails, gloves that look like gardening mitts, and lots of old-timey lingo. He recently sat down in our studio with the Conversation's Maddie Bender to talk about his plan for the Vintage Aloha Baseball League and the history of baseball in Hawaii.
So there were some figures in the 1800s that moved to Hawaii and brought baseball with them. So there was a lot of baseball activity going on in Hawaii before even on the West Coast. So it goes way back to the mid-1800s. And then from there was plantation teams that would form, oftentimes segregated by ethnicity. So there was a Portuguese team, there was a Puerto Rican team, a Filipino team, Japanese, Chinese. And so they would all just play pastime baseball on the plantations. And then you go from there into the 1900s, and there was a local Japanese team called the Asahi that was incredibly popular locally, based off of a team with the same name from Vancouver. So there was several Japanese Nisei teams that were popping up around the island and performing and playing in their own leagues. And just kind of took off from there, which we would get barnstorming teams from made up of major leaguers coming to Hawaii on steamship as a stop on the way to Japan. So there was a figure named Lefty O'Doul from my hometown of San Francisco that he was kind of heading that, and he's a member of the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame because of his influence in Japanese baseball. And so he would bring Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and showcase their skills here, hit balls into the ocean, just kind of put on a show for the locals.
Do you know how baseball got introduced here and why it took off, especially thinking of Hawaii as like a mixing pot, all these different cultures, not all of them familiar with baseball?
I think that's just really what it is. It all boils down to, like, it was a thing to do on the plantations. That's really where it took off. There was a man named Alexander Cartwright who ended up moving here, and he set up shop here, became a firefighter, and he is credited with being one of the first people to showcase, like, the game sort of as we know it, as far as, like, you know, nine players on a team, the bases being 90 feet apart, four bases. There's a little bit of speculation on to what his exact influence was on the game, but as it stands right now, and they haven't changed it yet, his plaque in the Baseball Hall of Fame includes a little blurb on his bringing baseball to Hawaii. And so there is some fuzziness involved in terms of, like, who was, you know, responsible for bringing it here and making it take off. But he's definitely a figure we look to. And, you know, as a constant student of history and somebody that just loves everything Hawaii history, everything baseball history, it's something that I'm dedicated to learning more about and trying to find out and now just digging up and showcasing, which is kind of what I'm trying to do here.
In your chronology, where you left off, we were seeing Hawaii as a place that barnstorming teams would come by. And now baseball isn't as big. So what happened in between?
You know, I think it has to do with football taking off. That's football is massively huge here. It's, you know, had to do with the once beloved Hawaii Islanders playing at Honolulu Stadium and then moving to the cavernous Aloha Stadium and then fizzling out in the late 80s. In terms of high-profile baseball, that's kind of where it ended. But it'd be, you know, an error to discount it there because there's Little League World Champions that come from Hawaii. There's Major Leaguers playing right now. Major League All-Stars, in fact, Major Leaguers that have won World Series that have come from Hawaii. And so it's still popular. It's just not quite as visible, I think.
But so what you're trying to do now is a revival in a couple of different ways. It's bringing live baseball here, but also hearkening back to maybe some of Hawaii's earlier history with the game. So tell us a little bit about that.
So I have founded the Aloha Vintage Baseball Association, or the AVBBA, which is based on teams of a similar nature on the mainland. You just call it vintage baseball, baseball being two words. And it plays by the 1886 rules set forth by the Spalding Official Guide to Baseball, which kind of showcased the game similar to what we know it now. But I think the differences is where playing vintage baseball is a lot of fun. Because I was a member of the San Francisco Pelicans squad there in the Bay Area Vintage Baseball Association. And it's wool uniforms, it's big, heavy lumber, it's little tiny gardening gloves, Victorian lingo, all sorts of little quirks that really, really make it fun and exciting to both play and watch. We'd play in Golden Gate Park, and just by virtue of us being in uniform, crowds would gather. Picnics would set up, and it was just an all-day spectator sport. So you could watch a doubleheader of two teams playing on a Sunday afternoon and just have a lot of fun doing that at the park.
What specifically about it or about some of those quirks made it interesting as a player and spectator? What did you like the most about it?
In a lot of ways, it's no holds barred. So there's, you know, you hear of the illegal pitch nowadays called the spitball. So you can throw spitballs all day long in the vintage leagues. There are a few different fun quirks. So like when you are coming up to bat, you refer to the umpire as sir, first of all, and he's dressed in a top and tails and sometimes smoking a cigar. And you tell him whether or not you want a low or high strike zone. And oftentimes that depends on whether or not you can hit a low or high ball. But sometimes you've been observing a pitcher all day and he's not hitting his spots. It's kind of fun to play around with that and see if you can, you know, force your way into a walk. Which is also an interesting quirk because instead of four balls, it's seven. So you can tire a pitcher out, or a hurler, as we like to call him. You can tire a hurler out pretty quickly if you can manipulate him a little bit.
And you think of pitchers in the major league today having to do 100 pitches, then they're out.
Yes.
But that would only get you a couple innings in baseball.
Add to that, you know, foul balls don't count as strikes. So if you've got an eye for it and you can foul them off, you can really tire the pitcher out.
Is there anything with the heaviness of the bat combined with the sad little gloves that makes either catching hard, balls go further?
It's sort of a free-for-all. It's you like to think you're good, and every time you do, there's something wacky that's going to happen. But it teaches you how to be a better fielder in modern-day baseball, because that modern-day glove is cavernous by comparison to the small, form-fitting, five-finger webless gloves that we would use in vintage ball. Add to that, the bats are heavy, and your obliques do get pretty sore by the end of a game. But kind of the goal is to use one ball per game, and so oftentimes a ball will get really ratty, and if it's wet outside, it'll get really heavy, which is why I like to say it's pretty accessible. It's a very accessible style of baseball to everybody, because no matter how good you think you are, it kind of humbles everybody. It's really hard to throw off of lower mounds with a limited windup and a really heavy ball. And so it's just kind of all over the place in the best way.
It's really interesting to me to think about this as a movement that you've seen become more popular in the recent years, because it kind of feels like baseball, Major League Baseball, is at a fork in the road. So you have something like the pitch clock to make games faster and more watchable. And then you also have a team like the Savannah Bananas, an alternative that is really bringing back the entertainment to baseball. So where do you feel like vintage baseball might fit into this whole conversation of what the future of baseball looks like?
Well, I think there's a new player that's taking the world by storm right now, Shohei Ohtani, which I am a San Francisco Giants fan, so it's not my favorite thing to see. But the sport is in flux a little bit. I don't really know where it's going to go, but it seems to be having a moment, I think, in a lot of ways. Like, a lot of traditionalists are seeing the changes to Major League Baseball and scoffing at that, but you know, a lot of younger people are taken to the game in ways that they haven't before, because it's not so, quote unquote, boring. You know, I do a lot of work in Japan, so, the stadiums are full in Japan. I travel to Korea a lot. The Korean Baseball League is having a renaissance of its own. I think the game, and with the World Baseball Classic as well, I think there's a lot of new countries playing baseball. So, you know, you have the Czech Republic, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, all relatively new to baseball, and you're starting to see it grow. You have Major League Baseball and played in London, regular season Major League Baseball games. And so I think it's a little bit difficult to see how the game is growing, but I do think it's growing. And I do think it's at least as popular as it's been, if not more than it has been in the last maybe 10, 15 years.
It seems like, based on everything you're saying about the popularity of baseball in other countries and in Asia specifically, Hawaii could be the prime place to have a baseball team.
Yeah, just like back in the early 20th century when it was a stopping point from barnstorming players going to Japan. I think in a lot of ways, it's the Aloha Baseball Association is something that I'm trying to have played over the wintertime, because first of all, there's the wool uniforms are very hot, and it's it would be absolutely miserable in the Hawaii heat to wear them. And additionally, I want to bring back that idea of barnstorming to vintage baseball. Playing in the winter over the off seasons of a lot of mainland teams, I would like to entice them to come to Hawaii and play in an annual preseason tournament that I'm calling the Kalakaua Cup. I already have two teams on board, one from Temecula and one from San Francisco, that are penciled in on arriving next year in November to help kick off the league. And I want to do the opposite as well. And potentially, if we can get some interest in the league and some players that would be willing to either take their entire club or put together an all-star team of Hawaii players to go to the mainland, go to Asia, I think that would be really fun and really very much in the spirit of old school baseball. Yeah, my former club, the Pelicans in San Francisco, they've been taking to barnstorming across the United States, playing not only other vintage clubs, but other sandlot clubs, and showcasing what vintage baseball is. And I think you're starting to see a lot of interest in vintage baseball form across the country. And I, want to continue that tradition here and hopefully be the lefty O'Doul of modern-day baseball and bring it to Asia. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
So What are you working on at this point in getting that league started?
Yeah, there's permits and insurance, and this has been...
Oh, the exciting part.
Yeah, it's not fun, and I've been doing it all by myself this entire time for about 2 years now, and it's been a lot of work to this point, but it's also... it's really exciting to finally announce it to the public and maybe try to entice some players to want to join. So I guess that's where I'm at this point, is trying to look for players of all types. If you're new to baseball, if you're semi-pro, if you've played college, if you have never played baseball at all, come on by. Let's see how it works for you. It's a lot of fun. And so, yeah, I'm trying to get some board members together. I'm working closely with Old Queen Street Stadium, which is a local museum / gift shop / vintage shop / showcase of all things Hawaii sports. And so they're going to be working on our uniforms.
Can we expect, since you're an artist, any custom logos or designs for the new league?
Absolutely. I have a rather conservative goal of having 4 teams to start, of which I've designed all the uniforms. But, you know, like, they're pillbox caps and cowls and ascots and just very, very old school baseball. It's a lot of fun to put all these things together. Like, and I guess that's another aspect of it, too, is I want to showcase old teams that played in Hawaii, too, because that's very much in the spirit of vintage baseball, is reviving some of these older teams that played, you know, in the late 1800s. And especially when there's so many interesting teams from the plantation era that there's very little photographic evidence of, but there's definitely newspaper clippings and information on matches that went down. And so to be able to try to envision what these clubs might have looked like and bring them back from the dead is just beyond fun. And it's been so much, it just brought me so much joy to put all that together and bring it back to life. My favorite is the Waikiki team, because I live in Waikiki. So they're just called Waikiki, or the Waikiki Baseball Club, or the Waikikis, as they were called in the newspapers. Additionally, we have the Royal Hawaiians, which were nicknamed the Royals. We have the Aloha Clubs, or they're also called the Alohas. And we have, it's a little bit not of the time, but I think it's something that I'm trying to get off the ground, and that's the Asahi team, or the Asahis. They started in 1909, I think, which... The game did change from the 1800s style to really closely resembling the modern style of it about 1900. So in spirit, I think it's something that I would like to revive as well.
Is there a way that people who hear this and might be interested but like have no idea what this looks like can find out more?
At this point, I'm working on a website that's not finished yet, but I do have 2 outlets that you can reach out to me directly. DM me at solario.art.waikiki. That's solario.art.waikiki. Or at Aloha Vintage Baseball, both on Instagram. And I have a running wait list of players, of fans, of people that are interested, photographers, just people that just think this is a really cool idea and want to be involved in any way they can. So, if you're interested at all, reach out and talk.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add, or any topic that we didn't get to that you wish we had?
I think another point is just really like... The vintage, like the Victorian slang, is just really a lot of fun. Aces or runs, instead of players, we're called ballists. The fans are called cranks due to being cranked up or cranky. Each match ends with both clubs lining up and thanking the cranks, huzzah cranks, tipping your caps and bowing to them for showing up. And so I think that's a lot of fun. It gets everybody involved and... you know, it's kind of like watching ghosts play baseball. It's really, really cool.
Like watching ghosts play baseball. That was Matias Solario talking with the Conversation's Maddie Bender. If you want to see his designs for the uniforms of the Royals, Waikikis, and other prospective teams, we'll have photos on the Conversation page of our website after the show.
If I pitch, can you catch? Will you hold the ball? When you step to the plate, will you swing and fall? If you play, you gotta know how it's done. Can you catch? Can you hold a hard one? I mean, baby, do you know the game? I mean, baby, do you know the game?
And now it's time to pitch you the answer to the Beckert quiz. Earlier, we asked you about Japanese baseball league legend and Hawaii hometown hero Wally Onamini. During his 12-year career in the Japanese major leagues, the NPB, Onamini won multiple awards and titles, including 3 batting championships, a Most Valuable Player Award, and 4 Japanese League championship trophies, mostly during his play with the Yomiuri Giants. Following his retirement, he became the first foreigner to manage a Japanese baseball club, in his case, his former team, the Chunichi Dragons. After his baseball career, he ran a successful pearl store, Wally Onamini Pearls, with his wife Jane in Roppongi Hills, Tokyo. Onamini was the first American to play baseball in Japan following World War II and is credited with revolutionizing batting techniques in the Japanese major leagues. Onamini died in Honolulu in 2011, a few islands away from his birthplace of Oluwalu, Maui, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. And congrats to Rex from Honolulu, who's a baseball fan. He shares with us that Wally went to his high school, Lahaina Luna. That's it for our quiz today. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. And that does it for us today. Tomorrow, well, all eyes are still nervously watching the events in South Korea. We'll hear from the Pacific Forum think tank. Have ties to Korea? Share your thoughts. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.